This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Better Watch Out, now available from Wellgo USA. Entertainment Weekly says, if you want to gift yourself a holiday film that decks the halls with blood, this is the one to put under the tree. You may be home, but you're not alone. Better Watch Out puts a gleefully twisted new spin on the home invasion thriller following babysitter Ashley, who must defend the kids she's watching against intruders one snowy night. Or so she thinks. Better Watch Out is now out on DVD and Blu-ray, and you can watch it on iTunes now as well.
Have you purchased your tickets to Texas Frightmare yet? The Shockwaves team will be there. Oh, yeah, we will for our fourth appearance. Yeah. It's the 13th year of Texas Frightmare, and that is something, especially with that number 13. That means they're celebrating with Jason Guest, Kane Hodder, CJ Graham, and Steve Dash. Also, all of them are also doing in-costume photo ops, which is essential for the big fans. The date will be May 4th to 6th, 2018, at www.texasfrightmareweekend.com. But the big announcement that dropped this week is that Clive Barker will be there. And for someone like me, that would be worth walking to Texas for. I've never met Clive, and we've met a lot of horror celebrities, and he's one of my faves. So that's pretty exciting. Also, on the subject, Doug Bradley, who I've seen in person before in Solaris, Ron Perlman, Matt Lillard, Tobin Bell, Sean Hotze, and the great Brad Dorff, and a few other Chucky guests to celebrate the 30th anniversary of Child's Play. Fiona Dorff, Alex Vincent, first convention appearance of Kevin Yeager, Catherine Hicks, Christine Elise. Of course, there are many more guests that will be coming. That's a fun thing about Texas Frightmare, even right up until like the week before. I remember last time there were some really cool people there. So if you've always wanted to not just listen to us, but also touch us in our face, be there.
Don't touch us on our face.
Okay, touch me in my face. Texas Frightmare, you can do that. That's what they're paying the big dollars for.
Okay, welcome to episode 77 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Elric Kane.
Yeah, in the flesh, man.
Yeah, in the flesh. Not everybody's here in the flesh.
Not everyone is
Rebecca
here.
Rebecca McKendry is here in the flesh.
I am here. Hello.
And guess what, folks? We're staring at this beautiful Skype image of Ryan Turek. He returns.
Is it 2017?
Yes, it is.
And we have never.
The future is here.
I know. Future, baby. We've never done this before. We always have the they must be live in studio.
Actually, you're right. We've never Skyped anyone.
We've never Skyped anyone in.
And the only reason is because we couldn't in good conscience do our top 10 of the year without the Voltron fully formed,
yeah,
as I see it. So welcome back, Ryan. How's everything going over there?
Thanks, guys. It's going. It's colder than I expected it to be in South Carolina, but everything is going great. Uh-huh. We are in our third week of prep
and, for a little movie called Halloween.
I think we can say Halloween.
That in case anyone doesn't know.
It's really funny because here in town, McBride and David Gordon Green are royalty. Like, wow. I was at a convenience store and there was an equivalent to, you know, like the Village Voice or LA Weekly, bad examples. Sorry. sitting on the sidewalk, and on the cover was it was Danny McBride. And it was like Charleston's own Danny McBride. And I was like, oh, look at that.
Aww.
And then it was really funny because I went to go see what he was saying about Halloween, and he actually was like, I can't say anything about Halloween. I was like, oh geez.
Yeah.
now after all of the press that we've been doing, we're finally clamming up about it.
So is the town fantastic. Is it small enough that like everyone's like really excited about Halloween shooting there, or is it
everybody when I go into Starbucks or I go into kind of like a little hipster cafe, they see my Michael Myers tattoo and they immediately put two and two together.
Wow.
That's pretty cool, man.
It's a lot of fun, but it's gorgeous. I mean, it's gorgeous here. I mean, I'm originally from the East Coast, but I've only driven through South Carolina on the way to Orlando on those family fun trips to Disneyland or Disney World.
Yep.
And it's beautiful. It's and the food is amazing. And if the food doesn't kill me, then I don't know what will. But it's great.
How's the new film end?
So break down the plot for us.
I won't die wondering.
We break the fourth wall and the filmmaker pukes some existential shit all over the screen. And
oh my god. Watch that actually be a news report tomorrow.
bloody disgusting report.
Existential shit.
Sorry for bloody
Well, that's great, man. And we're glad to have you back at least to do this episode.
Yeah, I'm glad we were able to work this out.
Yeah, and we got tons to talk about. Obviously, we're going to count down our top 10 of the year. But look, this is our last episode of 2017. Kind of crazy. And so let me remind you that we are all over the social medias. So if you haven't already, you could find us on Instagram and Facebook as Shockwaves Podcast. And then on Twitter, it's Shockwaves Pod. And of course, we're on iTunes, so be sure to rate and review us there. And we are also now on Spotify, officially. So many places you could find the Shockwaves crew. So that's for starters. Also, I want to pimp out during the break over the course of the next 2 weeks. You should go back and listen to episode 32 of Shockwaves. That was last year's Christmas episode where we reunited the killers of Silent Night, Deadly Night 1 and 2. Historic. We're not even going to try to top that.
So. We are not going to ever do another Christmas episode unless we think we can get top that? Close
yeah,
to that.
That was
we need a new breakthrough. Probably Joe Dante. That would probably make sense next year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something
and so,
like that.
So we're going to have to cap it off here until January. So that's that. All right.
And
so,
while we're plugging stuff, as I've mentioned on past shows, I'm doing, or we are, because it's the Shockwaves Etheria Scholarship, we are doing a scholarship for female filmmakers. I mentioned it last week, but through the end of the month, if you get something at the Etsy store Illuminated Horrors, 100% of the proceeds will go to the scholarship.
Yep.
We have signed 8x10s there of the Shockwaves crew.
In case you don't want a photo of our faces on your wall, which I wouldn't.
You don't want Kane on your wall.
This is the awesome Devin Whitehead Shockwaves image and Aaron from Cavity Colors, and it looks actually really cool.
The shocker graphic, and it'll be signed by all of us. We have stickers, we have t-shirts, all types of really cool stuff. Yeah. So please check out Illuminated Horrors on Etsy or Eatsy or however the fuck you said to
definitely not
Eatsy.
All right. Appalachia, it's Eatsy. We'll just give that one to you.
Eatsy.
Well, let's dive into it. Ryan, since you've been gone for a little bit, anything that you've had time to see in the intro that you'd like to talk about?
Well, since my family is all the way back on the West Coast, my weekends are lonely.
Oh.
And I've been catching up on my usual art house, you know, Oscar bait. And like I saw Lady Bird and Disaster Artist and stuff like that. But I did catch up to The Slayer, which Arrow did a beautiful restoration and release of. However, this movie is dreadful.
Yeah, I don't recall this being good.
I felt guilty a couple months ago talking about it. I felt bad. I know you did.
And you know what?
It looks so cool.
Because of your review, I put it off. It was at the top of my pile. And then I just kind of went back down to like 20th position.
No.
And I saved it for watching out here. And this, man, I mean, there are some really great kills in this movie. Really great kills.
Yeah, on their own, yeah.
There's one really silly kill, which I would love to just – I'm sure it's online, but just look up fishing hooks in ocean and Slayer death.
do you know that's shot down by you? That's Tybee Island, which is off Savannah.
Is it really?
So right now you could go to where Slayer was shot.
You know what? This weekend I'm going to take a Slayer tour.
And some Madhouse was filmed down there. We like that one. City of the Living Dead.
Some good stuff down there. Great. But man, Slayer's not good. But I also watched, you know what? This has been – the trip has been just watching shitty Blu-rays of special editions. I watched The Unholy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
That Vestron put out.
I love that movie.
Becca, this movie is terrible.
Yeah. I haven't seen it in 20 years, but I like it.
I used to love those films. In the 80s, those like crazy priest ones, like The First Power and things like
that.
That was good. Unholy, it's not a good movie, but it's somehow interesting for me. And I love the like redhead female demon-y
gooey thing. Well, that's the thing. It's about this succubus bait more or less that's preying on these priests that are at a very specific church, and it opens with a priest who cannot fend off this hot redhead lady, and then she kills him, and then Ben Cross from Dark Shadows comes in and he's the new priest, and the movie spends its time basically with you know, these kind of like older priests telling Ben Cross he's the one, and I'm not really sure why he's the one or what that means to be the one, but I guess he's the one to be resilient to this succubus's needs and desires. And then it ends with a giant fucking four-legged monster running through a church while these two dwarf demons jump around in the pews, and Ben Cross is like saying prayers, and there's rain, and there's
unholy communion.
Oh my God.
But it was a blind priest who told him that he's the one, if I remember correctly. And that makes it meaningful. If a blind priest tells you something.
If I recall when this movie came out, I remember, you know, when you're, when it came out in 88. So in 88, you know, I'm in my like early teens, you know, when I think I remember reading that this movie pushed a lot of buttons just because of its depiction of the priests. Mm-hmm. Like it depicted them as sexual creatures that had desires and sexual, you know, demands. And I was like, oh, I want to see this movie. But it took me, you know, over 20 years later to figure that out and see that it was terrible. But you know what? It's part of the Vestron library. I shall keep it, just like the Slayer remains in my life.
And they're numbered, those Vestron titles, so they know how to get us compulsive types. Yeah. All right, well, let's do non-crap. How about that?
Has anyone got any non-crap? Is the question.
I do. Right. And I'm mentioning this only because it is not on my top 10, although I know a lot of people will choose it, but I did go to see Del Toro's The Shape of Water.
No spoilers, because I'm excited.
No spoilers at all. I, for the most part, loved it. I think it's a great movie. I don't think it's a horror movie. That's the main reason why I can't put it in good conscience in my top 10 of the year. And that kind of took me off guard, because Del Toro is like beyond genre at this point. It's like, it's a Del Toro movie. And it also wasn't like a Creature from the Black Lagoon remake or reinterpretation as I anticipated. The best thing about the way that I got to see it, because I saw it here at the Arclight in Hollywood, and the Arclight is one of these theaters that if you stay after the credits, certain movies have kind of an interview with the director that's like special for that screening. And so it just made total sense. Del Toro did a little Q&A thing after, and he's, you know, they're like, when did you come up with the idea for The Shape of Water? And he's like, actually, it was when I was a little kid, you know, I don't know, like 8 years old or whatever. He's like, I was watching Creature from the Black Lagoon for the first time. And there's that amazing scene where Julie Waters is swimming on the ocean, and underneath doing this like dance is the creature. And all I could think of is, boy, I really hope those two end up together. And that was the beginning of it. Like, he's like, that's when I came up with the idea for this movie, is when I was a little kid hoping that the two leads of Creature would get together.
I really want to read the person who wrote the book version of Shape of Water, which the movie somehow spun out of, is Daniel Krauss, who I talked about last week, who wrote Rotters.
Yeah.
And I
want to read that. Was your best friend.
Yeah, I know. We're like tight on Twitter.
Are you sure somebody told me that wasn't true? Somebody said he
did a book, but all right. So in that same Q&A, I think Del Toro said that he bought the idea from someone. Yeah. And then kind of did the story, because he gets story credit and written credit is all to Del Toro in the movie itself. And so I wonder if they kind of came up with the story together and then he adapted the book version of it.
Yeah, because Daniel Krauss wrote Trollhunters.
If only we could just go on Twitter and find out if this information is correct.
And that's not, we got to throw credit to Vanessa Taylor, who co-wrote Shape of Water with Del Toro.
Yeah.
She co-wrote the script for the movie.
Yeah,
and she's doing the next film with Del Toro as well.
Oh, beautiful. Nice. And so, yeah, I mean, without giving anything away, it's a really beautifully crafted movie. I think it's set in the 50s or 60s, and it really captures that time. Del Toro is on fire in terms of directing. It's got a fluidity to it that really draws you. Like, I'd say the first 25, 30 minutes is just like the camera's constantly moving. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, you're getting kind of wrapped up in this whole like whimsical story, which is basically a mute, like kind of a mute janitor that works for this facility and is very lonely. Her best friend is Richard Jenkins, who lives next door, and he's kind of like a failing artist. He, you know, now he's one of those guys that paints like all those amazing advertisements, and now they're transitioning into photographs. And so he's kind of not getting work anymore. And and basically, you know, Michael Shannon is this kind of evil military guy that's in charge of this project that's at their facility, and it's a merman, for lack of a better term. And I'll leave it at there, because then there's a lot of beautiful. The thing that's interesting is it taps into a lot of. I mean, the whole idea is how how even our differences are not really differences. You know, there's racism is attacked in it. There's even like a sexual harassment sort of scene that seems super timely, all things considered. You know, sexism, like all that kind of stuff is kind of there. And the whole idea is like, look, even though we have these differences, we're all the same. That's, you know, man, creature, woman, we're the whole same thing. We all have the same kind of feelings. And so I loved it. There's one thing in it that I will talk off camera when you guys finally see it and we could get a little spoilery that I don't know if I'm okay with, and that's why it's not a perfect score for me, is that the last couple of movies, Del Toro keeps pushing. He gets to a point and then he pushes the boundary on one aspect. And I feel like he's like, all right, I got you. Now, will you accept this? Because I felt like that way about Crimson Peak. Like, I think Crimson Peak is beautiful, but I think the violence, like there's one ridiculously violent death that is completely unnecessary. And then like a butt shot. And I'm just like, is that the reason this got an R rating? Because neither of those are like, they don't add anything to the story. And right. So with Crimson Peak, I think he kind of lost me by just throwing in a really violent, horrific, gory death that to me felt like...
Was that the bathroom one?
Yeah. It's like, wild, why is that there? Because the rest of it doesn't reflect the rest of the movie at all. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like he's at that point where he's doing his own thing and he likes to push one thing forward and see if he can... If he can get away with it. That's my feeling. Yeah. So I can sum it up in two words if you like, after you see the movie.
I'm looking forward to it.
But I do love it, and I think it's great. I think everybody should go see it, especially on the big screen.
Right on. I only saw one thing. I saw it last week and forgot to talk about it. 7852, the Psycho Shower documentary.
Oh, yeah. Ooh.
I really liked it, and I thought it was really compelling. I liked the style they chose to tell it in with the little recreations. A lot of it shot in black and white, and a lot of what I liked about it, kind of like Room 237, where you had a lot of people trying to theorize, most of them celebrities in this case, like filmmakers, trying to theorize, you know, just kind of the meaning of it and the way Hitchcock went about it and the cutting edge. The only negative I could say about this film, and it might be because perhaps there's not any really good resources of it, but I felt it was missing Saul Bass's voice. And people mentioned Saul Bass, but like, you know, there's a lot of theories that Saul Bass was the main creative force behind actually designing.
Oh, so they don't touch on that controversy at all?
They don't touch on the controversy. They mentioned Saul Bass, but I thought at least you'd find some like old audio of Saul Bass or something with him, and he's not in it. So I don't know if there's a reason. Maybe they're making this with the Hitchcock estate, because there is a Hitchcock in it for sure, one of the granddaughters. But it's still really good and compelling. And of course, I thought of you because, you know, you've done the whole all the Psycho films and a doc. But this was cool because it was specific to the show. I didn't feel it was really competing, actually, weirdly enough, with your territory, because it was just so specific. But I did feel that was missing, because I don't think it has to be controversial necessarily that Saul Bass might have had such a big hand in. It's just a shame he wasn't kind of getting any credit in this documentary for
It was a thing for years that he claimed that he kind of directed it, like that it was his. And then if you look at the documentary that's on the Psycho, you know, whatever edition of Psycho you have at this point, DVD, Blu-ray, there's a full-length documentary, and they kind of – Hilton Green, the AD, puts it to rest that it's like, no, Hitchcock directed the whole movie. Saul Bass did do incredible credits, and he did storyboard the whole shower scene, but that was based on Hitchcock's direction of it. So I thought that was interesting.
And you can say that about a lot of movies, like The Thing. If you watch the making of The Thing, they talk about all the amazing storyboards Rob Bottin and the storyboard artist created for the movie. It's like no one talks about them directing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can see why that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
But amazing pre-viz, because he really did, because Hitchcock replicated those storyboards.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, but who cares, you know? God, we're not going to go into another controversy on this show. Who really directed it?
Who directed
it? I'm not touching
Psycho.
It. Last time I got in trouble.
Yeah.
Beck, anything
else
for you?
Yeah, mine, I watched a lot of stuff like catching up on this year that I'll talk about when we do our top tens. But this one, I'll say it's not exactly horror, but definitely will be of interest for the fan base. Mansfield 6667. It's a documentary. I found it on Amazon. I assume that it's available on other things. It is a documentary on the last 2 years of Jane Mansfield's life, but it specifically focuses on her activities within the Church of Satan and her relationship with Anton LaVey.
Oh, I know the documentary.
And so it's fascinating.
It was rumored. I never knew it was real. Like, I know it was heavily rumored.
It was rumored that they were having a relationship. Yeah. Like, she was definitely involved in the
church.
That's pretty wild. Although, the degree, like, there's John Waters is interviewed in it. And he even has this wonderful line where he's like, can you really picture Jane Mansfield like sacrificing a goat? And it's true. And so it really looks at Jane Mansfield's life, kind of her downward spiral, but then like how the Church of Satan was functioning at the time, the images that they were portraying, why they were doing certain things, and kind of like how it conflicts with, you know, the certain type of persona that they had in Hollywood. And It was really fascinating. Really good look at Hollywood kind of right around the late 60s.
Sounds like a prequel to Starry Eyes.
Yeah, it feels a lot like that. But yeah, a lot of, you know, it specifically focuses on Mansfield, but there's a lot of like really good Hollywood material in it.
Beautiful.
I've got actually one more that I forgot I watched when I touched down here. Demon Seed.
Oh yeah.
Oh boy.
Let me drop some knowledge on you about Demon Seed, guys. Have you ever seen this?
It's Donald Kamel, baby. I know all that. Love that.
I have never seen this movie before. It's based on a book by Dean Koontz. And it is, I mean, like we love saying a word bonkers. It is truly the most bonkeriest movie I've ever seen in my life.
Especially the ending.
The ending from top to bottom, this movie is batshit insane. Yeah. But it's basically, just for you guys out there, it's about more or less an AI developed by a genius kind of dude who has a wife at home in this beautiful home that is more or less like it's a smart home. It's a smart home. It's a home way ahead of its time and very much before, you know, Simpsons did an episode about a smart house. And this AI gets developed and injected into the smart house's like servers. And then the smart house / AI develops a relationship with the housewife while the husband's away. And then develops a relationship to the point where it wants to impregnate her and then inject its consciousness into her child and then become this elevated being.
Oh, it's like,
totally, totally get that. Yeah.
I mean, this guy's, I mean, like, if you,
why are you so judgmental?
I'm not judgmental at all. I mean, like, listen, man, I'm all for house human relations. But holy crap, guys, this thing is insane. Like it was one of those, I had to watch it in two doses because I kind of started nodding off, but I woke up at this point in which a character comes walking into the smart house and the house is on defense and it turns into something very material. It's like this kind of weird geometric shape made out of metal and it moves around the house and through the floors and like it has like a giant kind of tentacle that wraps around you and crushes you. Do you remember that already?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. I guess kind of like techno Lovecraft.
It's a techno. Yeah, very much so. And then like when she finally has sex with the house, it becomes like this kind of trippy, altered state-esque montage of images and,
well, also, it's like a very classy actress. It's Julie Christie, and she's like, you know, kind of British royalty actor. You don't expect her to be in a movie fucking a house.
Okay, I've got to rewatch this.
And Becca's like, house fucking.
I don't recall the house fucking. Yeah. I recall the smart house. I don't recall house fucking. I'm in.
Oh, yeah. Fritz Weaver plays the husband, the genius husband. Yeah. You've got it's just insane, guys.
For those at home who listen to our show and know my love for the White of the Eye, the slasher same director, Donald Kamel, didn't make a lot of performance, co-directed it, but
wow. Yeah, I mean,
it's just like 1977 in a big studio movie with Julie Christie about a woman and a house and an AI. I mean, like they would never have gotten away with that today. Never.
That's my holiday break aside because I own it. I bought the Warner Archive Blue. I haven't watched it yet.
Please watch it. And then I will listen in as you guys recap because it is. I gave it to Green here. I told him all about it. And he was like, what? And then I gave him the gift of Demon Seed.
Wow.
My Demon Seed.
Wow.
Hey now. I just want to make a quick mention of two more things that I saw. I think, Elric, you might have talked about this one, and it is a Christmas horror movie.
Is it set in Wisconsin?
I believe so.
Does it have a samurai?
Yes, it does.
Oh, I know where you're headed.
The insane people from Vinegar Syndrome have put out Bloodbeat Blu-ray. And just to give you a little context, and I hope he doesn't mind me telling the story, I'm going to keep it the mighty Joe Bishar, composer Joe Bishar, had invited myself and Mike Mendez and Brian Collins, our guests from last week, to watch a movie. At his new place. I won't say much about his new place, but he's got his own theater, like an actual theater in his house. And so that's what we watched. What I love about his theater is that I brought The Devil's Honey, obviously, because we had talked about it last episode.
That sounds like a party movie.
And both, it was Collins and Mendez, so I figured I can knock out both in one shot. Yeah. And then, God bless Bishara, he's like, oh, I just got Bloodbeat. You want to see this? And so, and he had to take out a copy of the Scream Factory release Demented. And I'm like, oh, did you watch Demented? He's like, yeah, I fell asleep to this last night. And so, you know, Bishar is the only guy I know on the planet that could have his own personal home theater, fall asleep to Demented, and then suggest Bloodbeat. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is the quality of movie that has to be seen at his home. And so, God, Elric, I need your help. Bloodbeat is not good.
Nope.
There's even a Shelley Duvall kind of ripoff mom looking person. And there's terrible acting. Although, you know, like the first 2 minutes I was kind of in, is the way it was directed looked like, oh, this looks pretty good actually. It's like a guy hunting deer. But anyway, they go back to their cabin and then they somehow awaken. It's Christmas, so there's gifts around the tree, and they somehow awaken the spirit of an angry samurai. And the samurai goes around slasher style killing everybody.
And then possesses the girl, right?
And every time he kills somebody, the girl that he's possessed, which is like the girlfriend, has an orgasm.
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah. Which is probably how it would go down.
This sounds logical.
If you're a samurai. Like, if you're mentally linked to a samurai, I guess murder would lead to orgasm. So Bloodbeat is out from Vinegar Syndrome. Watch it if you dare.
Isn't there like crazy food being thrown across, like a fridge
scene?
That's
where,
like, the most memorable thing I remember.
Like it's almost like there's some sort of possession thing happening and food is flying around everywhere. And I
feel like that's
the
kind of movie that
out.
Should never be on a good copy, though. I feel like it was nice discovering it as a shitty kind of...
I couldn't believe how good it looked for what it was. Like, scanned from the 2K scan from the original negative. The only thing that doesn't work is they couldn't find the credit reel. And so literally, just as the movie ends and the characters are walking towards screen and the credits come up, it goes to a VHS version. So it kind of added to it. And also worth mentioning is Scream Factory put out Misery, the Rob Reiner movie, and new scan, new features. There's a really great like hour-long interview with Rob Reiner. The movie still, I've always loved it. It's one of my favorite Stephen King adaptations, and Stephen King will come up a lot in our top 10. Yeah. It is just as great as I always remember. I think that movie's kind of flawless. Every time I watch it, I think it's great. So, if you are even remotely a fan of it, you have to get that Scream Factory version because it's great.
Nice.
And that said, anything else before we do this?
No, I mean, let's...
Everybody brace yourself.
Why don't we talk in general before we get into it? Like, how'd you guys feel this year compared to, like, the last couple of years?
This year was not... This year, what I discovered is... last year, I felt like there was really good stuff across the board. Like, I was seeing it both on, like, small micro-budget, on kind of mid-range indie level, and then also some decent blockbusters. This year, I felt like I was seeing the two poles. Like, it was either really small micro-budget stuff that I liked, or it was, like, giant blockbusters. I wasn't feeling, like, and most of it was in the big blockbusters this year. I wasn't feeling as much in between.
I remember it being hard to limit to 10 last year. Like, I had, like, 15, 16 where I was like, oh, my God, this is hard. This year, I felt like my top five were, like, better than the last couple of years, but that after that, I didn't really care.
Yep,
like, I didn't have much dog in the fight after.
Agree with that. I had a tough time. Like, I started strong, and there was a lot of enthusiasm jotting down the titles that I have, and then it just kind of started waning by number six.
And I still say that, like, anything from five and above, I could probably rearrange depending on what day you asked me.
Yeah.
Where I'm just kind of like, yeah, they're all okay.
Well, yeah, I had to go back and remind myself because my memory is that this year started really strong. Like, there was some – I remember just super early in the year, like by March, I was already like, oh, man, there's some really good stuff coming out. Like, this is going to be a good year. And then we got kind of an interesting dynamic with studio horror. Like, obviously, there were a few really big hits that, came kind of late summer going into Halloween. And so I thought it's been an interesting year. I didn't have too much trouble in my top 10. There were a few that I ended up leaving off that we'll talk about in notable mentions, but I think it's safe to say that usually the top five are kind of the most solid picks. Mm-hmm. And again, like Becca said, I think they're probably interchangeable. I mean, yeah, there's some that we'll like more for different reasons, but I thought it was a pretty strong year, regardless.
I don't know. I was also looking at things like Jigsaw and Rings and then just kind of going,
did any of us see Jigsaw in the end?
Rings.
No, I didn't.
No one even
Rings,
saw Rings.
Rings doesn't praise at all. That one didn't. But I mean, Jigsaw was just, it just flatlined. So no, I didn't see it.
No, but it made money.
Jigsaw is still playing out here.
Yeah, it made money. It did well.
Have you seen it yet, Ryan?
If it's still around by Saturday, I'm going to try to check it out. I would like to see it on the big screen.
Yeah, no, I'd like to see it before it all is said and done.
Regardless, but it's not making our top 10.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to make a top 10.
Will it make anyone's 10?
Well, let's rock and roll. So as Ryan's not up till 2 a.m.
And so we'll do it. If we mention a title that other are on our list, I'm sure you guys can chime in.
And then when we get back to it, it's like, all right, we talked about that.
Yeah.
So
there you can add your two. Yeah. If you want to add more later, if it's higher on your list, you can. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Cool.
I'll kick us off and then we'll go kind of around the circle. My number 10 for the year is A Dark Song. This is one that I saw pretty late, like actually probably within the last month. And I heard a lot about it. I know, Elric, you saw it earlier in the year and talked about it. Mm-hmm. And it is one of those films that not only people that were friendly would keep talking about it, I've seen it mentioned a lot in the group. And it is really good. It's what I like about it is its ambition, because it feels like a much bigger movie than it is. It's basically two characters in a house. And it's a directorial debut from, I'm drawing a blank on his name, but
Liam Gavin.
Yeah. And so the idea, I love when somebody has, to me, that's my favorite type of storytelling, where you have a really ambitious idea, but you almost don't have to show that idea. Yeah. It's executing it through two people almost talking about that idea. Yeah. And so that's what that is. And also, they don't really tell you right off the bat what is going on. You just know it's like these two characters by chance are meeting up. One wants the other to do something. And so I found that part of it unsettling. And just, you know, great acting, great story. The ending's really kind of out there and bonkers. And I enjoyed it tremendously, and I'm glad I caught it before we did this list, because it was going to be somewhere in 8, 9, or 10. But I decided 10. It just made my list, and I think it's a really solid one.
I love the procedural element of it. I kept thinking it's like The Wire. You just keep watching the process of what they're trying to do. It's a lot higher on mine. So I'll chime in a little bit more later on it, but my number 10, I struggled 9 and 10 the most, because there's so many kind of fringe movies that are just you don't want to leave them off. I actually went with something that when I saw it in theaters, I liked but didn't necessarily love, but it's really lingered in my mind. And it's topping a lot of like art house indie film lists, not so much horror lists, but that's Personal Shopper by Olivier Essiasis. Yeah, the Kristen Stewart film. It's got this really beautiful kind of lyrical quality to it. It's about kind of a haunting kind of story. It's a girl who's lost her twin brother, and she's trying to figure out some way to communicate with him. And that's obviously, being an art house French film, it's not that concerned with horror. And my problem at the time was right when Romero died. And my problem with it was it just doesn't want to be a horror film. Like it goes to all the places and builds all the tensions of a great horror film, but it so clearly is in denial of being a horror film. That was my problem at the time. But I have to admit, I've kept thinking about it. It's definitely one of the best performances of the year. Like Kristen Stewart, someone I have no interest in, is completely hypnotic in this. And I talked about it at the time, but the thing I keep coming back to, it's not so much the spirits. I'm not 100% in love with the way they're kind of visualized in this, but it's there's this long sequence where she's receiving text messages, and she's on a train going back and forth between like England and Germany, and you don't know who they're from, and it's super dread-inducing, menacing, and it keeps building and building, and then she returns home to an apartment, and there's something behind a door, and it's shaking and rattling, and you don't know, like, is it a murder? Is it a ghost? And it's fucking easily one of the most creepy and dread-inducing sequences of the year. It's like 20 minutes of the movie, and that's what I really remember about, like, kind of come away for. So I like, you know, it's not necessarily my favorite. It got released to the Criterion recently, which I was kind of surprised.
Yeah.
You know, again, it might not be for every horror fan, but there's something about this movie that did kind of stay with me. So it trumped out about three other kind of art housey ones that I'm going to wait to see if they end up on your other guys' lists for me. I had to choose carefully which one I'd let peek in. But I like it. It's an interesting movie.
Okay.
My number 10 was Annabelle Creation, which I wasn't really expecting. I watched it just this past weekend, and it was one of those that I hadn't rushed to see because I really didn't like Annabelle that much. And
At all.
Yeah, I was not a fan of the Annabelle movie. And so going into this, I only watched this because I'd heard you guys say that it wasn't half bad.
No,
and,
beyond half bad, it's really entertaining.
Yeah, actually, really, and well, I can't say, like, I could punch holes in the story about how, you know, Annabelle is locked in a closet and for some reason she can't open the closet door, but she's throwing chairs in the basement. I could, you know, you have to overlook certain things. But that said, some really good jump scares in it. And there was a lot of really good tense moments. I liked the mythology that they were building. I liked the origin story. I liked the girls. I liked the rest of it a lot. So don't go into it, you know, with a self, you know, don't analyze the shit out of it. But I thought it was just fun.
Yeah, I said this a week or two ago whenever I'd seen it, that it's a good little horror movie on its own, but really what it is it's kind of like it's the film that pulls the quote unquote Conjuring universe together. Like it's the one that is like they needed one movie to kind of fill in all the gaps and make them all connect.
And somehow they brilliantly
did that.
I liked the ending, like once it clearly ended, and then I was like, why is the film still going? Oh, bad move. And then I saw where they were going with it. I was like, oh, that was actually pretty
basically
cool.
They made the first one a little better. they managed to somehow what's the word again when you
embellish?
No, retcon. They retconned the original.
Oh yeah,
and
oh,
made it
yeah.
work. So,
that one I literally was wrestling for that for my 10th spot. But what I am gonna say is like if I was choosing my like director of the year, that would be honestly in horror would be one of my picks because I think he is making that movie so much better than the material.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
oh,
David
yeah.
Sandberg, hats off, man. Because
he Ouija origined that show.
Just those gags are so freaking good. You know? Yeah, exactly. You're totally right.
What about you, Ryan?
My number 10 is one that came out a long time ago, but it finally came out this year, The Devil's Candy by Sean Byrne.
Oh.
I feel like it needs to get – I feel like these movies that get lost on the festival circuit or just like, you know, make a lot of buzz on the festival circuit and then go quiet because they're dealing with distribution stuff, I feel like they get lost in top 10 lists when they actually come out. But I thought that – The Devil's Candy, which was written and directed by Sean Byrne, who did The Loved Ones, which I'm not entirely a fan of. I think that this was a significantly better movie. I just kind of liked its icky pulpiness, but it's also it's like the family dynamic, which is led by Ethan Embry. You know, you automatically side with this family who, you know, move into a house that's got a bad past. And then, you know, it just worked on multiple levels for me. And, you know, once you put this, you know, maybe it's just a personal connection and just because now I'm kind of like a family man, I just kind of like immediately identified with this guy who's willing to hold his family together while dealing with the kind of,
dark forces,
I guess,
of the house?
No, not the dark forces, but just shouldering a lot of pressure from work. I mean, he's a painter by nature, you know, he's a painter in the film and he's getting pressure as an artist, to, you know, deliver something that he's not entirely sure he wants to deliver. And
he
kind
of
so,
has to get
know,
possessed just, by it, right? The art, like that was the
yeah,
interesting
yeah, exactly,
thing. He has
exactly.
to give himself over to create great art, but then you feel guilty about it.
Exactly. And it all comes to a head when, you know, when the sinister character comes into their lives. And I just dug it. And by the time the heavy metal started kicking in with the end credits, I was all in. I think it's a fantastic movie and it really stuck with me. And when it hit Netflix, I had to watch it again just to kind of, cause I had seen it like 2 years prior at TIFF, you know, and you kind of ride. You wear festival goggles. You know, festival goggles do exist, I believe. When you know, everybody gets all hyped up and excited about a film, and then they spread the word. And this movie, I think, definitely holds up well.
Mm-hmm. All right, and we may hear about it again.
Yes,
in a while. I agree.
I think I'm the only one who, at the time on first viewing, it didn't fully work for it. I want to watch it. Yeah, I was surprised because everything about it kind of ticks my box. But I was for some reason outside that movie, and I that one. There's two movies I want to watch again this year. Where I was like, man, that and another one might come up. Transfiguration. They're the two movies this year that, on for whatever reason, I feel I should love and didn't, and I don't know why.
Transfiguration didn't do it for me. So,
we'll get there when it when they come up. But those are the two that I'm curious.
Okay. Well, we're at number nine, and I just realized I looked over my list. The thing about all my picks, except for one, is that all of these I've only seen once. And so whether it was the beginning of the year or later on, I've only had one impression of them. And so basically my top 10 is based on my initial reaction to the movies, my memory of what it made me feel like. Mm-hmm. So my number nine is Happy Death Day for sheer fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know,
like
so much fun.
I honestly didn't think that this movie was going to be kind of catered to me because let's face it, I'm an old man and it's definitely aimed at a much younger audience. And yet Elric and I got to see it together and we were like alone in a theater watching it. And you and I started laughing and like kind of, you know, hitting each other and talking about stuff. And like, It reverted, at least watching it with you made me feel the way I felt when I used to rent slashers with my friends from the video store.
Like the perfect date, guys.
Plus, we're having a shitty day. I remember we're having a really shitty day.
We had a really bad day, and that cheered us up.
You guys were bitching like hell before you went into that. I remember that day.
Elric almost wasn't going to stay.
Yeah, I remember that.
I've actually been converting a few people who just don't believe me when I tell them about this one. They're just like, no, it can't be good. And I'm like, the thing about it that will win you over is the charm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This has got genuine chemistry and charm between the two leads. You like both of them.
Yeah.
You want to see good things happen to them, and that's a nice feeling. Because we don't get that from horror very often. Like, if this was my comedy list, it'd be in my top like three comedies of the year.
Yeah, it is really
like
funny.
Like, as a comedy, a divorce from horror. You know?
Right. And you know what Brian Collins said last week on the show? I thought he really hit the nail on the head of why it appeals so much to slasher fans is like, because your lead is the bitchy girl from the beginning and then becomes the final girl.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh yeah, we get both stereotypes like within one movie and it's the same character. So I just had so much fun with it. And so that's why it's up at my number nine.
Yeah. I give that respect. What do you think, Ryan? Is that a good movie?
Happy. I should do my usual, like to the listeners, my usual, obviously Blumhouse films are not in my top 10, but Happy Death Day would be, and Get Out as well. And Split.
All right.
Nice. Yeah.
All right. Elric,
number nine. I'm going for something unusual for me because it's kind of a comedy.
Unusual? And... You? Get out of here.
I think personal
shopper really threw us.
Yeah.
No, that's
all
such
know.
A cane.
I don't know where you're coming from.
This one is unusual for me. Like, this is like the opposite. I don't know. It stayed with me. It's funny. It's light. It's like, I don't want to say forgettable, but it's you know, that ilk, and it's Tragedy Girls. It worked for me. Like, I don't know. I'm still kind of giggling to myself about some of the gags in that. I think it's one of the first horror films to really kind of nail social media. Mm-hmm. Like, even though they're doing it as a comedy horror, it really gets under the skin of kind of just the superfluous nature of what it means to be, like, you know, media stars and, you know, the lengths people go through. But it's purely comedy. Like, I think, you know, it's similar. I think Super Happy Death Day, as I like to call it, has more emotional depth in a way, like, because you know, you really care. It's not so that's not what this film is, but it's so much fun. And I think if you liked Happy Death Day, you'd probably also like Tragedy Girls. Again, it's only kind of really coming off the festival circuit now. Mm-hmm. But you know, I enjoyed it. It's like, you know, I'm sure I talked about it at the time, but you know, there's an actual kind of Jason Voorhees type character going around killing people in the town and in the opening scene. So I don't want to go much past that, spoilers, but two girls who look like victims kind of turn the tables, and then you start to realize that, oh, they're worse than him in this town because they want to do it for social notoriety.
Yeah,
and they're trying to like grow their social fan base on their web pages. So it's somewhere between like Scream the TV show and some, you know, and a good heart, like what was the Final Girls, the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's somewhere
yeah.
between those two. I really, it stuck with me. I'm surprised it's in my top 10, to be honest, but I want to be
Tragedy Girls made my top 3.
Okay, it's awesome. Then I don't feel so bad. Good.
Nice.
It's a cool movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my number 9 is La Place's Demon, which I don't think any of you guys have seen yet, right?
I saw it. Becca, I saw it with you.
Yeah, Turek was not as amused.
La Place's Demon?
I actually watched it this week myself, actually.
Did you like it?
I don't know how I felt about it. I thought it was interesting.
I've never even heard of this movie. What the hell is
this? It's coming off the festival circuit now.
La Place's Demon.
So this one, I compared it to like Twilight Zone, like an episode of Twilight Zone if it was stretched out to a full movie. And I liked it because it was very stylized, but and I mean, don't go into it expecting the monster to be scary. They definitely kind of build up this like scary monster that's roaming the house, and I mean, it's a Twilight Zone episode, so don't expect it to actually look terrifying. I really liked the setup of it, and I love the theory behind it, which is that it's this group of scientists who are trying to study the way that glass breaks. And so they're saying that if they study the way that glass breaks enough, that if you were to drop a glass, you could predict how many pieces that glass will shatter into and the where the pieces will go. And this is an actual theory, that if you could do that for every single thing in the world, predict the movement, the physical movement of every molecule, that you could potentially predict the future. And so that's the idea. And so these people are invited to this mansion on this like crazy island, and it's very stylized. And someone has predicted their every movement and how they will respond in every situation. And knowing that, he's planned out ways to kill them, knowing how they will respond to every situation. And it's very hyper-stylized. It's very bizarre. It's kind of, it's really campy at moments, but I just found it fascinating and had a really good time with it. And yeah, I think I made Ryan go see it at Fantasia.
Yeah, it's black and white. It's Italian as well. Uh-huh. It's in Italian. But a rule. So we're allowed to do, because you're doing a festival movie.
Uh-huh.
That's not out.
That one, I don't know if
there's a reason I watched it.
Oh, okay. Oh, it's not out yet. Okay.
So we'll let that slide then.
Okay. Well, I can sub in another one if we need.
Well, because normally we forgot to do that at the top. Is basically we like to do movies that A, came out this year, and B, people could see.
Is Tragedy Girls
out yet? But
this is
Becca's
Tragedy Girls
first time
came out in
doing the show.
Oh, go fuck yourself.
This is the first episode, so she doesn't.
Tragedy Girls came out theatrically in October, so technically it did come out.
The Placeless Demon did theatrical in October as well, because I saw it again here in Los Angeles.
Okay.
It did. Although it might be part of
distribution, though.
It's part of Screen Fest when I saw it the second time.
Festival.
Right.
Holy shit, it got tense at number 8. I can't even get to number 8.
We'll let it go.
Becca's going to movie jail.
I got others. If I need to sub in, I got others.
No, I like this one because I don't know anything about it. So keep it
so
on the list.
So keep an eye out for it.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. Coming soon. That should be the advertising. Becca's number 9.
Coming soon.
when they actually get it out. Ryan, what's your number 9?
My number 9 is Nacho Vigalondo's Colossal.
Oh, interesting.
I it's not necessarily a horror movie, but it's kaiju, and it's it just hit all of the it just strummed all of the right strings for me, all the right notes that I just kind of love. I love fucked up love stories. I do like Anne Hathaway. I do like giant monsters stomping around on cities, and I like Nacho Vigalondo. Since he did Time Crimes, he's always been a filmmaker that has introduced interesting ideas to cinema. With Time Crimes, it was a weird, kind of time travel movie with extraterrestrial. If you guys haven't seen that one, it's kind of a chamber piece, again, a romantic story about a guy who wakes up with a girl after a one night stand and discovers that there's an alien invasion, and then her boyfriend comes home. And it's just about like these three characters trapped in an apartment while aliens are running amok in the streets. But you never really kind of see that much.
He did a good VHS segment.
Yeah. It's
fun. That one's interesting.
But with this film, Anne Hathaway plays kind of like a drunky party girl who's got to get her shit together, and she goes back to her hometown and runs into Jason Sudeikis, and she discovers that she has an avatar that pops up on the other side of the world, and it's a giant fucking monster. And Jason Sudeikis, it begins as kind of like the love interest, but then you discover there's more to him than meets the eye. And that kind of plays into both the kind of larger repercussions, the worldwide repercussions that are going on, and then what's just going on at home and her getting her shit together. I watched it recently because I had seen it at Sundance. And again, it was just, I kind of like, these movies that I really like really on in her year, I try to just kind of revisit just to see if they still hold up months later and after the kind of hype died down. And I didn't really kind of follow what people were saying about Colossal, but I rewatched it on Hulu and I just kind of got sucked in. I watched the first 5 minutes and wound up 90 minutes later watching the whole thing again. I think Anne Hathaway, delivers a really great performance. I think Sudeikis does a kind of fun Jason Bateman in The Gift kind of esque turn And then there's a lot of great, you know, character actors like Tim Blake Nelson and stuff like that. But it's a very, and also Dan Stevens is in it as well. But for Vigalondo, I feel like it's his most accomplished and mature work, both on a narrative and just a visual level. So I dig it.
Cool. Excellent. Let's see. Number eight. Oh, number eight is maybe it might cause a little fuss here. We'll see. Shit. It's a movie I saw this week that I know you guys have talked about quite a bit. And I don't know what to tell you. I kind of loved it. I kind of had a great time watching it because I knew nothing about it. And that is Life.
It's in my honorable mentions. I had a great time with it.
It's in my Turk. I want my money back.
Well, I remember, Ryan, you sort of liked it, right?
He liked it.
No, he did.
I think it was a blast.
Well, here's the thing. So, all right. So it's directed by Daniel Espinosa, and it's written by Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, who are the guys that did Zombieland and Deadpool most recently. And it's got an all-star cast. It stars, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal, Ryan Reynolds. I just had no expectations for this movie. I got it on Black Friday for like $5. I was like, all right, I'll check it out. What the hell? And you know, I don't want to knock another movie for one, but like, you know, Alien Covenant was a huge disappointment to me for what that should have been. And this was kind of like an interesting, surprising, suspenseful take on Alien, but not copying Alien, by doing kind of its own version of it. Kind of like, you know, adding this aspect of like, germ phobia. Like what if there is an alien, but it was also like a germ or like something in that realm where you don't really know what it is. And so there were some scenes that right off the bat had me like kind of like squirming in my seat, you know, in particular when the guy's got his hand in and this thing wraps around his hand and you're like, oh my God, how is this going to work out? And then, you know, a lot of surprises, the way that the story unfolded, I was just kind of really shocked at some of the kind of twists and turns of the movie. The ending is really cool. I wish basically my only problem, and hopefully this doesn't ruin it for other people too, is I found the entire movie unpredictable except for the ending. And the only reason I predicted the ending is because the box says you'll never see it coming, the ending. And so I'm like, well, now that the box says it, I'm going to look for something. But I just had a lot of fun watching it. I thought it was actually much scarier and suspenseful than most things I've seen as of late.
It has one of the best horror sequences. Ryan Reynolds stuff is great.
Yeah, it's
in this
great.
Movie.
It's that's the thing. It's yeah, great. And that caught me off guard. Yeah. I wasn't expecting any of that. And I've already gotten shit for giving it a high review on my letterbox. So that's why. But I don't care. It's my number eight. I liked it. So there you go. Life.
I mean, there's things that I definitely liked about it, but ultimately I was underwhelmed. And you know what? I also unfortunately saw it in theaters the day everyone was saying it was a sequel to Venom, a prequel to Venom. And so I couldn't help but watch every frame going, maybe this is the part where they get space suit. It was just the most ridiculous rumor.
But I watched it, and it's number one on my honorable mentions list because Ryan had seen it like the first weekend it came out, I think,
yeah.
And you mentioned
I went opening day.
Yeah, and then you came into the Monday morning Blumhouse production meeting and was like, guys, go see it. It's awesome. And so I went that night to see it because Ryan gave it such an endorsement in the Blumhouse production meeting. And I went that night. And so I went in positive about it and had a blast. And then when I saw everybody shitting on it, I was like, I thought it was fun. So,
it's definitely not a movie worth to be shat on. I agree with that. I think it's really well made.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially the space shooting, like the way they're actually shooting it to make it look like zero gravity. It's mm-hmm. pretty kind of amazing, that part. I think I just felt like it was kind of joyless. Like Gyllenhaal plays such a serious character. Just something about it drained a bit of the life out for me. Yeah. But my number eight is a movie that Ryan put on my put on my list, and I was very excited to see it, and I really enjoy it. And it's lower because it's less of a horror film and more of it could also be in best art house drama of the year, but it happens to have tentacle monster fucking people. And that is The Untamed by director Amat Escalante, which I really enjoy this movie. And I think it probably if I just did a top 10 of the year movies, it might be even higher than here. But
I'll
as a horror film, I think it's a little lower.
It's my number eight as well.
Okay,
so yeah, it's which is why I literally just leaned over and pencil wrote to Elric, just making sure this one's out. yeah, so that's my number eight as well as The Untamed.
Yeah, I hope people give this one a shot because it's a totally unique movie, and it's like you'll be just watching like literally a sexual marriage drama playing out, and then suddenly you'll go into a really spacey, dark, dread-inducing forest, and the kind of music and haunting soundtrack kicks in, and it really becomes horror. So it's kind of it really is a mix between horror and drama. But it's a unique movie, and I'm looking forward to seeing it again, to be honest.
Yeah, like, and even though I knew where it was going, I didn't know quite
exactly
where it was going, and so like you knew it was coming up to like tentacle porn,
and it's still open-ended enough to have lots of different interpretations of what it's even about, and I like that about it. Mm-hmm. I bet I'll see it a second time and have a slightly different read on it.
Yeah.
So thanks for putting that one. It almost makes up for life. Brian, well done.
Yes, Untamed.
So that was Becca. That was your number eight.
That was
my
number eight as well.
Oh my god! All right, Ryan.
My number eight is The Girl with All the Gifts.
Ooh.
Yeah, Cole McCarthy's movie completely took me off guard. I hadn't really paid any attention to it early on when people were talking about it, you know, because it's an adaptation of a novel. But you know, it's just one of those. It's one part zombie movie, one part character drama about this this girl named Melanie who's kind of half zombie, half human. There's a lot of twists and turns that are involved. But I thought it was a remarkable performance by this young actress, Sanaya. And Glenn Close plays kind of a villainous turn, and they got Gemma Arterton, but it was just a great, I just got sucked into the world building. And, you know, Cole McCarthy, who, you know, I wasn't too familiar with as a filmmaker, he delivered on a lot of great scares. Like, I actually jumped a couple times watching the film. So if you got me, if you can get me there, then I'm all yours. But it's just a really classy, well-crafted, beautiful looking, well-performed movie that I feel just kind of went under everybody's radar. And I think more people need to see it. And that might be just because of the kind of, the people who had read the book just wanted to steer away from the film. I haven't read the book. I'm just going based on the film only. And I think the film stands on its own pretty well.
It's another one that I think suffers from my Walking Dead like aesthetic burnout, because it has some similar aesthetics, mm-hmm. even though it's got bigger ideas. What is the one they come at? It Comes at Night. There are the two where I was like, I feel like I've been watching this for 5 years.
Yeah, I liked
even though it's original.
I liked The Girl with All the Gifts, and it definitely went in really original places. But I was just so zombie burned out by the time I saw it at Beyond Fest.
Oh, that's right.
And when I saw it there, I was just kind of like, this is great. I've seen zombies a lot this year. And yeah, so I completely forgot about it really quickly.
It's also that post-apocalyptic militarized world. I think that's the thing that I'm like, but it does have a lot of original beats, and like, I'm sure, again, maybe one I have to revisit.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but it's on Amazon Prime. Here's the funny thing. I keep confusing this with The Cure for Wellness. It's like those two. And when you said The Untamed, I totally remember that trailer, but I kept thinking Lore? The Lure.
Mermaids.
Yeah. That's what I keep confusing all these
Lure.
Movies. So I have to watch all of them anyway.
Yeah.
And also, I should say The Girl with All the Gifts also has, hands down, probably one of my favorite horror soundtracks of this year.
Oh, cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's rare. I think it's a Cristobal Tapia Vendivir. I'm butchering the name, but Death Waltz Records released it on vinyl.
And cool. As we go, like, you guys at home on Twitter, just please send us a tweet. Which round do you think Ryan will fall asleep? As he's starting to slur his words.
He's 3 hours ahead of us, and we're slowly watching him sink further down in his chair. His head's in his hands.
Number
now.
Six, he's just unconscious at number six.
It's like midnight your time now, right?
No, it's 11 o'clock.
11,
not
okay.
yet. Not yet.
I mean, it's in old man Turek terms, that's past my bedtime.
Yeah. All right, number seven. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because we talked about it last week, pretty lengthy. And it's 1922, the Stephen King adaptation, which is currently on Netflix. And it was a Netflix original.
I listened to you talk about this last week. And I added it to my queue based on your review.
You haven't
review.
Seen it yet? Have you watched it yet?
No, I haven't seen it yet, no.
It's really good.
Yeah, I mean, much like Life, it's something that I only watched in the last 2 weeks and just completely caught me off guard because I knew nothing about it. I think the thing that sets it really apart from – I mean, I think it's one of Thomas Jane's best for performances. He's like so – he's unrecognizable and he's so good that, again, like you were saying last week, Elric, like sometimes you get him really great and sometimes you don't know what you're going to get. This is one of his best performances. Right there with Mike Flanagan's Before I Wake, which, by the way, will also be on Netflix January 5th. We should mention that now, finally, for our U.S. listeners.
Relativity finally let go.
I guess so. And, you know, Mike's done enough for Netflix that I think maybe they made that happen. So 1922 Stephen King adaptation, Netflix, and there's going to be a lot of King probably talk tonight. But if you haven't seen it, I just think it's a great, dark black, not, well, it's not even black comedy because it's not really funny. It's just, it's a really, it's got that Fargo-esque sort of vibe to it. And I strongly recommend
it. And the ending stuck with me. Like at the time, I remember Dick really loved it and he told me what, and I was like, yeah, it's good. No, it's really solid. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think much about it. But lately I've been like, oh yeah, that ending kind of is pretty haunting, just how it all comes together. So
yeah,
he's a good character. I will see your king and add some king to the pile.
Oh,
a little
bit
of what was meant to be an unfilmable book with Gerald's Game really blew me away. Because I had just read it this year as soon as I heard about it being announced. And I loved the book. And I just kept thinking, how will you do it? I guess you're going to end up like softening out, especially on the flashbacks and what happened to the protagonist when she was a child, the sexuality of it. But they didn't, and they found a way to do it. And I really think this is a great adaptation. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it will end up in like probably my 10 favorite King adaptations. And it has, you know, one of the most horrific scenes
of the year.
And it's just fascinating. I'm actually another film I want to see it again. Like I'm actually excited to rewatch it. And kind of once you're past the surprise of how somebody has done the adaptation, how he's changed certain voices of characters, the cleverness of those choices, Flanagan as a creator, as a writer, and problem solving is what really impressed me about that piece. And if you haven't seen it on Netflix yet, you really should.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I will take your king and your raised king, and I will go Scandinavian fishy sex musical.
Yes.
Oh my
As
God.
We just mentioned, look at that.
With the lore. Cool movie. I absolutely loved this movie. There were aspects of it that I, excuse me, didn't think gelled as well as others. But that said, I had a fantastic time seeing it. I don't know if it's horror.
It's horror enough. They are vampire mermaid things.
They're eating people's hearts. It's definitely got some
horror imagery for sure.
Yeah, horror imagery for sure. But yeah, it was just kind of like somebody said, let's make mermaids. Let's make them really gross yet sexualized.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like part of the story of the Little Mermaid, but it's got this neon demon-ish quality to it along with disco dancing. So yeah, the whole thing, it's just bubbling over with a lot of stuff that I just really enjoyed.
You know me, I'm not the musical guy and I still really enjoyed it. Yeah. I thought it was super fun.
It was just
surprising. It's surprising. It's poppy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like
and it's not a musical, because I know as soon as people hear musical, they're immediately put off. It's not a musical as in like, I am fallen in love with this guy. Now I'm going to go sing on a windowsill by myself for an hour musical. The musical songs are stage productions. So it functions very much like Phantom of the Paradise or Streets of Fire, where it is a musical, but they're musical performances within the movie.
Yeah, they're musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and there's another one Criterion put out. It's just like,
yeah, it's very interesting.
They're on top
of these foreign like horror.
And it's just vivid. I mean, like it is kind of neon demon-ish where even if there's nothing going on, you're just like, this is really pretty.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful. All right. The lore. All right. Ryan, number seven.
The lore. I want to preface my number seven by just kind of reiterating what I kind of forgot to mention is that a lot of my stuff in the top 10 is stuff that I feel is of my taste. I will revisit multiple times and I just think is great. It's more of a favorites than what I think is best of the year. I didn't preface any of that. So I just want to say that. So having said that, Raw does not make my top 10 because I've only seen it once and I just kind of forgot about it. But my number seven is, I see you shaking your head, Elric. my number seven is Super Dark Times.
Oh,
Super Dark Times. I just went mute. Sorry, guys. Super Dark Times really stuck with me. It taught me that teenagers are fucking horrifying and can go to really dark places and do really fucked up things.
Only in the 90s.
What's that?
Only in the 90s.
Where no, they fucked up. They're constantly fucked up. But no, it was just like, it's one of those kind of coming of age stories that just, that just works. You know, it's one part kind of tale of obsession, tale of consequence, tale of, you know, mental illness. There's just a lot of things at play, and it's done in a, it's done in a fashion that I just kind of like, I was attracted to, and I still think about the film, and now that it's out on VOD, I've been meaning to kind of revisit, but man, that movie is just spectacular. Not a straightforward horror film per se, but you know, just one that just kind of sets you on edge. And I just felt like once the kind of inciting incident in this film happened, I was just, it just made my skin crawl the rest of the way.
And you weren't on the show when the writers came, right? You were away that week, I think.
Yeah, I was away
when
that week.
When Ben and Luke came? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad that made your list. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. all right, so we're up to number six, correct? Mm-hmm. All right, and this was already mentioned, so I won't spend too much time on it. My number six is Annabelle Creation. You know, for me, it's more about the experience, and I just had so much fun watching it. It's David Sandberg has like kind of mastered kind of the traditional horror roller coaster vibe. And so this is a movie that I'm sitting on my couch with the lights all out, cranking the sound, and I'm kind of on edge and kind of waiting for the next thing. So it's just so much fun. And again, like I said, even though I love the Conjuring movies, not as big a fan of the first Annabelle, but this one kind of almost made up for it and really made me excited about what's coming next. Like, obviously there's a reference to The Nun, and then the way it ties into the first Annabelle and obviously the Conjuring movies. I just had a blast with it. And so, that's why it's pretty high.
Of all the films I saw this year in theaters, that played the best with any crowd.
Yeah,
like,
and that's,
the crowd were just mm-hmm. played. It was like so entertaining to watch.
And yeah.
I had so much fun just seeing people react to that movie. Like, it's, you know, you need those still. You need those kind of movies.
Yeah. Audience pleasers.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, my number six, Annabelle Creation.
My number six, it's a movie that probably won't come up on the show, called Super Dark Times. Oh, Ryan. Oh. Number six. I'm slipping them up one from you. I went to school with two of these three creators. So, but I really, this movie, I can't wait to see it again. I think it's like really a great thriller. I feel like that Stand By Me quality it has, it's going to have legs. I think like 10, 20 years, people will still go to this. The voices are just so real of the characters in the first like 30, 40 minutes.
It has legs, Ulrich, but it's up to you and I to get the word out more.
I feel
not enough people are talking about it.
Yeah, and I think maybe, I don't know what their deal was, their distribution deal, etc. And I think maybe it's when it comes out to like Mark says, well, I don't know if they have a Netflix deal, but if it eventually comes there, I feel like so many movies that we talk about, it's not till it hits that place where everyone can get to it. Mm-hmm. But this movie's fantastic. And as Ryan says, once it starts going and you're not 100% sure, you're like, oh, did this guy do something? Did he not? I won't get into spoilers, but it just moves. And it's so, and you're really placed in the protagonist, the one kid's head so well that you're constantly like having his same doubts about his friendship and stuff. And I just love the way it unfolds. It's probably the nicest surprise of any movie I saw this year, where I was like, went into it not knowing what to expect, knowing that people I knew had made it, which you're just never sure how that's going to go. Like, I know we all have had that experience where it's like you feel guilty or bad that you didn't like it. And I walked out of that one going, man, I've never been so proud of like people I knew making something this good, you know? So super good movie. If you haven't seen it, got to watch it.
And I've been watching Ozark on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
It's been great to see that, that actor, Charlie Tan is on there. He's fantastic.
My number six is the one that Ryan didn't include, Raw.
Oh, look at that.
Do you not like it, Turek?
No. I think it's very good. I think it's very good, but and it was a great debut, but I don't know. It's just when I was making the list, it just didn't – maybe it's my like number 11 or honorable mention, I guess.
Well, you are right. It isn't one that I would watch again. But it was one
really?
That
really I'm dying to watch it again. Like,
are
I,
you serious?
Yeah, no, I'm like, can't wait.
It's I mean, it's intense, I guess.
Not
that's
the horror
fine.
Parts, but more like the aesthetic. There's
the
something about the aesthetic that's
it,
really
it's
hot.
It's very like, white and pastel-y.
Yeah,
and
the soundtrack's really interesting.
The soundtrack is cool. And I love the and Turk's in bed now, everybody. Yeah. He has made it to bed.
Guys, I gotta tell you, podcasting from bed is the best.
He is literally laying down in bed right now. Anyway, but I loved the idea that it is a cannibal film, but it feels very untraditional cannibal film. Like, and we're not seeing a lot of cannibal films right now. It's nothing that's really happening trend wise. And so to see it in quite this brutality and it be like a 17-year-old girl or 16, she's supposed to be really young in it. I think just gone to college.
Yeah, so she might be up to 18.
Yeah, 18. Sure, yeah. But
she looks young.
It,
she's very young looking.
And how it almost kind of, you know, because she has just gotten to college, there's definitely kind of a discovering and dealing with bullying and things like that. Like it coincides with self-discovery. So there's this whole idea of kind of like a puberty-ish thing. And I just absolutely loved it. It was definitely one of my favorite screenings of the year.
I got to say, I think it's like after I watched it, I went to discover her short film that has definite connections. And it was like yeah. I had to buy some subscription to some shitty streaming service just to watch it.
Was
and
it called Fandor?
No, it wasn't Fandor. I've never heard of that one. But it's a great
we're
short.
We're thankful for this year,
yeah.
Fandor.
It's the same actress. So she really wrote the feature for that same actress. And the girl's incredible. I think this is like the birth of a major talent. Like I think The Babadook's a great movie. And mm-hmm. I think that director will make another great movie. But with Julia Ducanau, I see this movie. And I'm like, if she gets funding in place and if the French government or whoever gets to lines up her next movie, I feel like this is the birth of someone who has like – I don't think it'll be necessarily horror. I don't know what she'll do. But I feel like it'll be something interesting
yeah.
and savage and just alive. Like, even if taking out the horror elements, I found the style of that movie to be really hypnotic.
I was also incredibly bummed when kind of the French extreme trend kind of panned out, because I felt like all those films, they were really pushing the envelope on obviously the extreme side, but that they all had something really important to say. And this one, I feel the same way. So I loved it because it kind of re-sparked it.
And I like this more in the sense that this has got a, I don't want to say supernatural, but kind of like, because like you're actually dealing with kind of actually a creature feature.
Yeah.
Whereas the other, most of the French extreme films were dealing with reality.
Reality. And
I like that, but that always does, that never, I never want to rewatch those for the most part.
Well,
but, you know?
Well, the thing with the Raw is that it adapts a creature feature narrative. It adapts yeah. the structure of a creature feature, yeah. even though it's
and,
not, she's
and
not
a coming
creature.
Of age film.
A coming of age film.
Yeah,
exactly.
Kind of like Wolfman. It has some similarities, I think, to Wolfman. It, like, obviously not the way it looks or feels, but in yeah. terms of the kind of story. Anyway, I love that film, and it will appear soon on my list.
Okay, so that's Ryan at number six.
Number six is Darren Aronofsky's Mother.
Oh, boy.
Mother made my list just because it's so bonkers and weird and just, you know, you talk about memorable, that movie really hung in there with me for a couple of weeks afterward.
Is that on VOD?
Even
yet?
Though I think it just hit VOD.
Okay,
but
I need to see it.
Is it pretentious? Yes. Do I fucking love that? Yes. Do I love that he was just throwing all of these things, all these themes about creation and being an artist and trying to balance art and social life and you know, and a relationship. I mean, like, there's just so many things being said in a very abstract, crazy way. By the time of Jennifer Lawrence, you know, it was funny because Collins mentioned this too, I think. Maybe it was Collins. But there's a point in which, you know, there's a dinner party being hosted and these dinner guests are getting unruly and they're doing things to their house. And Jennifer Lawrence is like, please don't sit on the counter. Please don't sit on the counter. And I'm like, oh my God, that is me sometimes. Like, I can completely relate to that. But you know, it's just one of those films that is, that I just felt was like one of the boldest movies to come into a wide theatrical release this year.
It's going to be one of those movies. I feel like it's going to be the cult movie mm-hmm. of the like last few years. The movie that won't will be disregarded largely for a while, and at some point people will go, "Oh my God, how did we?" Because it's such a different, bizarre.
Yeah,
it just didn't make mine. But it's one of those movies where, like, the first half, the horror film part of, I love the first half of that movie, and then the second half, I'm going to have to watch it again because there's so much to fucking process. It's so crazy. But I totally respect Aronofsky for getting to make that. It's so cool that somebody went all in.
Yeah. I still can't wait to see it. I haven't seen it either. All right. So number six for Ryan was Mother. All right. So we're about to hit our top five, but why don't we take a break to hear from our sponsor one more time. This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Better Watch Out, now available from WellGo USA. Entertainment Weekly says, if you want to gift yourself to a holiday film that decks the halls with blood, this is the one to put under the tree. You may be home, but you're not alone. Better Watch Out puts a gleefully twisted new spin on the home invasion thriller following babysitter Ashley, who must defend the kids she's watching against intruders one snowy night, or so she thinks. Better Watch Out is now out on DVD and Blu-ray, and you can watch it on iTunes now as well.
Have you purchased your tickets to Texas Frightmare yet? The Shockwaves team will be there. Oh, yeah, we will for our fourth appearance. Yeah. It's the 13th year of Texas Frightmare, and that is something, especially with that number 13. That means they're celebrating with Jason Guest, Kane Hodder, CJ Graham, and Steve Dash. Also, all of them are also doing in-costume photo ops, which is essential for the big fans. The date will be May 4th to 6th, 2018, at www.texasfrightmareweekend.com. But the big announcement that dropped this week is that Clive Barker will be there. And for someone like me, that would be worth walking to Texas for. I've never met Clive, and we've met a lot of horror celebrities, and he's one of my faves. So that's pretty exciting. Also, on the subject, Doug Bradley, who I've seen in person before, and it's hilarious, Ron Perlman, Matt Lillard, Tobin Bell, Sean Hotze, and the great Brad Dorff, and a few other Chucky guests to celebrate the 30th anniversary of Child's Play. Fiona Dorff, Alex Vincent, first convention appearance of Kevin Yeager, Catherine Hicks, Christine Elise. Of course, there are many more guests that will be coming. That's a fun thing about Texas Frightmare, even right up until like the week before. I remember last time there's some really cool people there. So if you've always wanted to not just listen to us, but also touch us in our face, be there.
Don't touch us in our face.
Okay, touch me in my face. Texas Frightmare, you can do that. That's what they're paying the big dollars for.
Okay, we're back, and we are counting down our top five now. We've done the first five. Bottom five is coming up, and this should come as no surprise. My number five is a movie that we've talked about literally for years since our previous show.
Holy shit.
And that would be Oz Perkins' The Black Coat's Daughter, a.k.a. February, as I believe it's still called February in the U.K., and you know, it's interesting. I think a big part of why, because I've seen so many mixed reactions to this film online, and especially in our group. And I think a big part of why this stuck with me the way it did is because I did see it at Beyond Fest on the big screen with a crowd, and it was just completely swept up and mesmerized by the story and how it made me feel. It's just one of those, it's not a traditional, oh, this happens, then this happens. It is a movie about how uncomfortable it makes you feel. And by the end of it, it just really it haunted me. It took me days to really process how I felt watching the movie. And on the complete opposite, I still need to give his second movie, I Am the Pretty Things That Lives in the House, a second chance.
Me too. Yeah, me too. I got
because I did not have that experience, and that was on Netflix, and you know, and it's equally as slow and deliberately paced. And
you know, Beyond Fest did everything they fucking could. They wanted that movie so bad.
And I would have loved to see it that way.
On a screen.
And our mutual friend Nick Simon got to see it on the big screen. And it was a night, a night that I couldn't go. We're probably doing the show.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I missed out not getting to see that on the big screen. But at the same time, I'm really happy that this movie finally came out, The Black Coat's Daughter. Death Waltz and Mondo did a great release of the score, which was done by Oz Perkins' brother, Elvis.
Yeah.
And what's cool about the score is it's everything. It's got ambient tunes to it. It's got like folk songs.
It's creepy, actually.
It's really creepy and unsettling, which is what the movie is. And you can listen to it digitally even if you don't want to buy it. You can just go on the Bandcamp for Death Waltz or Mondo, and you'll find the soundtrack. So yeah, my number five, and I believe you could find this on Amazon Prime, or it's fairly easy to find.
I think it is now. Yeah, I also just found the Blu-ray was like at Best Buy for like $10 suddenly.
One I would own. Yeah, I would own that Blu-ray.
I completely agree. I think you've totally hit why this film hasn't been. Well, also maybe it's distribution problems.
Yeah, it took a while.
But I think for me it was getting. Yeah, I got to see it at one of those early after you, but it was still at a. I think it was their agency screening or something weird. I don't go to those things, but it really has a power on screen. I always cite the one scene because there's a car and it's going off into the darkness and it's small and it's going and the length and the wide vista kind of shot is gorgeous. But I'm like, man, I showed it to Dick on my home TV and I was like, oh, all the power of certain sequences don't exist on a TV format because it's not bigger than us. And there aren't many horror films being made like that. And I think he really leads with the aesthetic and the slow burn nature of it. I think asks something of an audience that maybe aren't as willing when they're watching something for free on Netflix, which is a shame because I think it's a great, really great movie.
Yeah. So that's my number five, Blackcoat's Daughter.
Cool. Number five for me is one you've already mentioned. It's A Dark Song.
Oh, cool.
So from five up, they're all films that could be, maybe not five, but from here up more or less could actually be number one in certain years. A Dark Song I need to rewatch before I could be that bold. But I really love the repetition of the thing, and I love the intimacy between this character. I love the dynamic, especially the guy who co-wrote and starred in what's the Ben Wheatley one?
Sightseers.
The Sightseers, which I didn't love that movie by any means, but I really love his character in this because you spend the whole movie trying to work out, is he full of shit? Like, is this just some fraudster who says he can contact you to the demon world? And he's pushing this woman to the absolute extremes because she's, you know, it's kind of like Don't Look Now if somebody came to them afterwards and goes, hey, I can reunite you with your kid.
Yeah.
And that would be this movie. And it feels almost of the same world too. I want to see it again just purely for the ending because it just is a movie that it goes somewhere. And so many movies are scared to go somewhere. Like Mother. Mother is definitely an example of that. It's like you have an idea and you go for it. And a lot of movies kind of half go for it and then hide and create something ambiguous or something just so that because it's scary to go there. This movie does the same thing. It gives you something big and it's up to you to decide whether you can take that or not. So I want to see it again. But man, I think it's probably one of the most atmospheric horror films of the year. I think it really nailed that feeling.
All right. So for you, Dark Song is your number five.
Number five.
Number five for me, Devil's Candy, which Ryan's already discussed. Definitely one of my favorites of the year. I loved the use of heavy metal and how it wasn't heavy metal that was bringing about the demon. It just happened to be there. Because usually if you see heavy metal in a movie, it's always like, oh, well, it's satanic and that's why the demon's there. And it wasn't. It was just
what drove it away, which I love. Yeah, it's kind of funny.
It kept it away. And I loved that angle of it, that the heavy metal kind of pushed it out. I loved the relationship between the dad and the daughter. And I loved the art angle, how it was focused on just three people, but it felt so much bigger. I thought Taylor Pruitt Vince, am I saying his name right? The guy who played the killer in it.
Taylor Pruitt.
I'm switching the names around, but yeah. I thought he was phenomenal in it. So yeah, it was just a really good time for me.
All right.
You guys think it's because I'm not into metal? I'm the only one of the four who wasn't into metal.
Not at all.
Okay.
Maybe. I mean, you liked A Dark Song, and that sounds like it should be a metal. Movie, and it's not.
Yeah, and actually, now that I feel like The Dark Song and Devil's Candy kind of follow the same.
There's similarities
beats.
For sure.
Like there's definitely pacing similarities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah.
Sure.
All right, Ryan, number five.
The Untamed. I kind of enthused about this film when I first saw it as just a screener that had been slipped my way, and I just couldn't believe what I was watching, and You know, this movie is a drama first and then a weird Lovecraftian tentacle sex monster movie later. And what it achieved was getting me involved in the myriad characters who are all dealing with their own levels of either sexual frustration or even relationship frustration and all that jazz. So I love this movie. I think it's so fucking weird and I cannot wait to watch it again. My only hang up is it does feel very long. Mm-hmm. But boy, are there a lot of rewards for watching it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Super atmospheric.
All right, The Untamed. I got to wait for another Criterion sale. Okay, we're up to number four. My number four is It, finally. Nice. Getting a lot of King this year. And this was, I think, I'd say this is probably the biggest horror movie. Well, biggest horror movie of the year, except probably what will end up being our number one for most of us. But it was amazing what an event it was, because I remember us talking about this last year as one of our anticipated. I think Ryan, you're the one that was like, you know what? I've seen enough so-and-so sequels in this. I haven't seen enough It. Like, we only got one version of It. I'm ready for more It. And so, I loved the experience of seeing this movie. I thought the actors were terrific. I thought it had some great scares. I thought, much like what David Sandberg does with his films, I thought it was orchestrated beautifully as a roller coaster ride. It almost felt like every 5 minutes was a scare. Mm-hmm. Like, that was what they were doing. The reason it's not higher up for me, and I know a lot of people will probably pick it as their number one, and that's totally fine. And I know I get a lot of shit for this argument, and it's totally valid. I just don't think it's a faithful adaptation. Faithful in spirit, but with the exception of one or two things, it's like, and the reason I say this is because I know the 1990 TV movie by heart. And I revisited, I spent the months leading up to the movie listening to the audiobook written by Steven Weber. So I listened to the source material right before I saw the movie. And yeah, there's some characters in the movie that weren't in the TV movie, and they move things around. And obviously it's in the 80s now instead of the 50s. Tonally, I get that they got it, but it is just, it's not faithful at all.
The headless Easter egg kid is awesome.
Yeah, no, and that's fine. I'm saying that those things are awesome.
But what about separating film from book, though? I mean, like, can you judge it on the film alone without bringing the baggage of the book to the table?
Yes, but that's also my argument for things like Kubrick's The Shining, and I know nobody will agree with me on this, but I like The Dark Tower. I have no association to those books at all. I just saw it as a movie. I watched it a second time on Blu-ray, right, and I was like, I dig this. This is a cool modern Western. I get that there's –
I haven't seen it, but I haven't had anyone else say that yet.
Yeah,
no
one else has told me
and that's fine, but I don't get it. Like, that's the thing. It's like, it's not a bad, unwatchable movie. Okay. Do you know what I mean? Like, I watched The Dark Tower again with my roommate, and he has no reference at all. He's just like, oh, yeah, that was a great movie. Like, very cool Western or whatever. And so that's my argument. It's like, because people just shit on The Dark Tower. And I know that maybe people just have a bigger attachment to that as a series and what it could have been. Mm-hmm. But why can't people separate that from the movie and just watch the movie as a movie? I mean, you've got great actors and great characters. And it just reminded me of, like, when we were getting a glut of Stephen King movies in the early 90s. You know, like, we started with Misery, but then we're getting Needful Things, and, like, just everything got adapted. And I thought that was cool. Like, not all those were 100% exactly like the books. But anyway, I digress. My point being is that I love it. It's my number four. One of the best experiences I had all year. One of the best horror movies we've seen in a long time, especially from a major studio. I'm excited for the sequel. And if the reason it's not 100% a perfect movie for me is because I didn't think it was that faithful. And also, this is the rare case where I think the second one will influence the first one a lot. Normally I say, no, just make one good movie. You shouldn't have to think about, but the sequel will be better. This is one of those rare cases where I think we actually haven't seen the whole picture yet. We need to see the second one to see how faithful an adaptation it is.
Yeah,
you know?
To see the whole film.
So anyway, that's my number four, It.
All right. Number four could easily have been my number one in a different year, and that is the movie that is not on Ryan's list, and that is Raw. I think it's a really special movie, and I'm looking forward to watching it again and whatever she does next. And if you can find the short, you should. And it's surprising. Many, many moments of that deeply surprised me, and it's still hard to shock the shockers. And there was a couple moments in there where I was a little shocked and a little disgusted. And I wish I had seen it in a theater, like at Beyond Fest.
I saw it at Beyond Fest.
Yeah, I wish
I'd
had that.
People were freaking out. And apparently at some of the screenings, like, people passed out. And
I can see why, because when you're dealing with things that are being eaten and stuff, I could see that can be too much for people, you know. But I just think this, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's on Netflix streaming free right now. Yeah. So is Dark Song. So those two are both on there. And Devil's Candy, quite a few of these so far. But yeah, I think it's dynamite.
Yeah.
Cool.
Number four, Happy Death Day.
Nice.
It's just fun. I mean, and I don't usually like slashers, but it was just a fun movie. Like, I went in just knowing that the basic, you know, kind of Groundhog Day premise, but not realizing any of the character stuff. And it was just a smart, fun movie. It's kind of the simplest way to put it. If you have not seen Happy Death Day, I highly recommend it, regardless of whether you like slashers or not. It was a great film.
All right.
Comes out on Blu-ray January 16th, everybody.
Oh, nice. Well, good to know.
Scoop. Is it on your list, Ryan?
No,
it's not. No, he
did. Oh, man, you don't even care for your own work. That's just, it's just pathetic, you know?
My number four is a short film that will hopefully make...
Is that allowed? Are you guys going to call cinema police on that shit?
I had to mix it up. Hopefully it'll hit the internet next year, but it made the festival rounds. It's called Great Choice.
I have to talk about it too. I love that film. That's my favorite short of the year, easily.
I have watched this short so many times.
So good.
And I know every little nuance. It's by a New York filmmaker named Robin Komisar, who does his own spin on a Red Lobster commercial on repeat and on VHS. And it just descends into utter madness. And it's
with
so
Carrie Coon, yeah, it's the great phenomenal. Performance by Carrie Coon.
Oh, fuck. I love this. I love this short so
I'm
much.
I'm totally with you. I think it's one of the best things I've seen this year.
By far.
Yeah. When a short film is able to kind of dominate the feature space for me, like when I come up with a top 10 list, that says something.
Yeah. No, I'm actually all for you including something offbeat like that, because that will draw attention to it too.
And that's not online yet, right? I remember that we got links for it like months ago.
It's playing at Sundance in January.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh. Guys are breaking the rules, man. Breaking the rules.
I guess it's new rules.
Great choice.
My number two, I'm going to call it my number 13.
Madness. Okay. what do we have to? Number three for me is Gerald's Game, which again, we've mentioned already. Netflix original. I think Mike Flanagan is on fire at the moment. I think he's definitely one of our modern masters of horror. He's just got such a great understanding of telling a story, and again, being able to adapt that particular difficult story as a movie is just, I'm kind of in awe of it itself. So I loved it. I the experience is great, but more importantly, it's got one of the most cringe-inducing scene that has been put on film and released this year, and that's why it's so high on my list. I just loved it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I kind of yelped.
Yeah.
I had to turn away a lot during that
and that's
sequence.
A lot for seasoned horror fans like us to do. So yeah, number three for me is Gerald's Game.
Yeah, it's a kick. And all the performances are freaking great.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
My number three, get ready to be shock shockers. My number three is Black Coat's Daughter. Number three? Now you're all like, that's his number one for 2 years.
You said it would be your number one whatever year it came out.
It was 2 years in a row. And then it took 3 years to come out. And I saw, and guess what? I saw even better movies. As much as I love it, I think part of it might also be the fact that when I rewatched it on a small screen, I was a little less like, you know, I think it's the kind of movie I'll keep revisiting because I love it.
Yeah.
But there's a couple things I saw that are even better, and I will actually stay on the side of that. So I love this film so much. I think it's aesthetic. This is the most of all the movies I've seen in the last couple of years. It's the most me in terms of the kind of things I love and respond to in horror. But even so, I saw a couple of things that I'm going to trumpet with this year. So sorry, shockers. It is number three, but it had been number one tied 2 years in a row. I had written it in. So Oz, come on. You got to get your movies out early, buddy. I know it's all your fault, I'm sure.
All right. So, Black Coat's Daughter.
My number three, you guys are going to give me shit for, and I don't care.
Oh, cool. I can't wait.
47 Meters Down.
Yes.
I thought.
At number one, three?
Oh, three.
Holy balls.
Seriously, guys, I had such a blast with this movie. I mean, I could just say because sharks and then just move it on. But I saw this at midnight on the day that it opened.
Get out.
Because sharks. So I saw it at midnight on the Thursday night that it opened. Wow. And I was like the only one in the theater. And I just had the best time with it. I went after trivia. We had trivia that night. And I literally, everyone was going to the bar. And I was like, sorry, guys, I'm going to see 47 Meters Down. And I left and went by myself and sat there by myself and had a blast. There is so much nonsensical shit in this about why the shark is chasing them all the way down and hanging around for like 12 hours just to eat like a scrawny little white girl. Yeah. I mean, there's so much stuff in it that, you know, I'm like, go find a seal or something. But so much fun. My favorite jump scare of the year by far. It's my same thing that I said for Annabelle Creation. Don't go in, you know, ready to poke holes. It's just a fun monster movie.
I like it.
I'm speechless right now, guys.
And I agree. I think that's my honorable mention. But guys, I got to tell you, I did a bad thing and forgot my cable for my computer at the office. So I'm at 3% right now.
Fuck. Oh no.
So I can either give you my whirlwind top three right now, or we can keep going around in circles and see where the Russian roulette ends.
You'll never make it.
You'll never make it at 3%. Okay.
That's 1% per title.
So I'm going to give you my top three right now.
Here we go. Ryan's three.
Tragedy Girls at number three. I think it's very innovative, clever, stylish horror film, which I really, really enjoyed. Teen slasher kind of movie. Killing of a Sacred Deer, which I think I talked about this a couple weeks ago, but I absolutely love this film. I saw it twice now.
So that's number two.
I'm going to weigh in. I know you're going to run out. This will be great if I talk over your number one. The only reason it's not on my list, because that is definitely one of my favorite movies of the year. The only thing
shocked it's not.
No,
on
but
my
the
list.
Only thing I can say, and I wonder if we saw it differently, is for me, it would never felt like a horror film because I thought it was so fucking funny. I thought I was watching just a dark comedy from start to finish, even though it's got horror aesthetics, horror soundtrack.
Elric is a man with two children. I am shocked.
I was laughing from start to end.
Colin Farrell needs to make the ultimate choices of mother.
Man, I even laughed at that part. I'm not kidding. If the person, people around me were looking at me like, what's wrong with this guy? Because it's, to me, a dark comedy that has horror aesthetics.
I didn't watch it because I thought it was about killing kids and I figured it would really like fuck me up. So I haven't seen
Becky,
it yet.
Becky, you've got two. Make a choice. No, I love it though. I'm with Ryan. If you haven't seen this and if you have a dark sense of humor, without a sense of humor though, I don't think you could get through it. It would just be too grim. But it's a fucking great movie.
It's a fucking beast of a movie.
I love it.
My number one, you know, I always talk about how I've always, you know, wanted to see the return of event horror. And I think it did that very well. Mm-hmm. You know, I love it, not just because it brought people out in droves and made people rekindle with horror and what scares them and rekindle their love for Stephen King properties. But I think that they just did a really fantastic job that they, you know, they had a lot up against them. I don't think that the TV miniseries is great by any means. I don't think it holds up very well, even though it was near and dear to me when I was a kid. But I thought it was a terrific, just straight up horror movie that worked really well. So there you have it.
All right.
Stay on the line. You're not going anywhere until it dies.
We'll stay until my computer goes black.
I'm curious. Well, okay, let's see if we can get through it.
We're happy that you could at least join us for this, Ryan. It would have been. It wouldn't felt right if you weren't here.
I appreciate it, and thank you for another year of Shockwaves. We had a great year, a great run. We did a lot of cool things, and I'm looking forward to what we do in 2018.
And we're all exhausted. I think it's been the most tiring of everyone's year.
Okay, guys. Okay, here we go.
Number two. I've been mentioned already and talked about a lot. My number two is The Devil's Candy. I just absolutely loved the experience of seeing this. I did get to see it on the big screen. They did an advanced screening of it at the CineFamily here in Los Angeles, and Ethan Embry was there, Keith Calder, the producer. And it was just I knew nothing about it. I loved The Loved Ones. And so getting to see this movie on the big screen and letting it play out and the tension, really it's about the characters. And I just fell in love with Ethan. I thought Ethan Embry was amazing in this movie. Really great performance. He's been doing a lot of great stuff kind of in the indie horror world lately. But this is the one that I thought made him shine. And I loved his relationship with his family and the way that the whole thing played out. You really cared what happened to them. So that third act, especially with an audience that was like screaming out and getting into it, it was one of my favorite experiences and by far one of my favorite movies of the year. So Devil's Candy is my number two.
Oh,
that's it. Ryan's out.
Goodbye, Ryan.
Oh, man. All right. Well, he made it to our number two. He'll have to listen to the rest of the episode. Elric, number two.
Number two for me is the best horror movie of the year, but it's my number two, and that's Get Out.
Wow.
Get Out is
the
utter...
shockers are going to be shocked.
Yeah,
that's
there's
going to
be some shockers, and we're going to have fun being shocked in a moment. But Get Out is utterly fantastic, and 20, 30, 40 years, it's going to be heralded in that pantheon of the best horror films ever made. And I truly believe that. I've seen it only twice, but I just think it's completely rich and it's just one of the best films ever. I'll get to the reason why it's not number one in a second. It's more about horror and that feeling of horror that I'm looking for. This, to me, is a lot more than just horror. It's like horror, it's comedy, it's satire, it's so many things.
Yeah.
But it's just such a good movie.
Yeah, it's one of those rare it just transcends all genres, but it also elevates horror,
yeah.
which is what we needed a shot like this. That
especially
was
one
from,
that says something.
Yeah, you know? That says something that was from a black perspective. And yes. It's the same thing, like, I know you've been excited about female directors just giving that slightly different perspective.
Show me something different. Yeah, show
and
me
so
your perspective.
And so that's what I'm excited about with horror coming in the next couple of years.
And the fact that it's in the Oscar contention is so freaking
oh
rad.
My gosh. Like, that, I mean, we've
it's been a long time.
It's been nominated for two Golden Globes now. Yeah. And when,
should be more
comedy.
Really,
yeah. Like, even today, I was at USC and some of the professors there are on the Academy board and they're all talking like, oh yeah, you do stuff with Blumhouse, Becca. Yeah, we've been watching Get Out and having discussions about it. And oh, I'm like, that is amazing right there to hear people on the Academy board talking about Get Out and, you know, how much it has brought to
it's
know,
brilliant.
The table
it's
this
brilliant
year.
Cinema.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's so good.
All right,
so,
Becca, your number two.
My number two is also Get Out.
Boom. Oh, wow. Yes. God, so, I can't wait to hear your number ones, both of you.
Get Out for me, amazing film. And that one, I got to watch in a very bizarre manner where Bea had said, do you want to see it? And I was like, yeah. And this was like a month before it came to theaters. Mm. And she was like, oh, just come by the office sometime. We'll set you up. And I literally watched it by myself in the conference room at like 6 o'clock on a Tuesday. And I watched it by myself and then couldn't talk about it with anybody. And so except Ryan, who I kept saying, like, the soundtrack. Now tell me about the soundtrack.
I don't really like seeing films in advance anymore.
Yeah,
like
it
that.
Was,
you know?
It sucked because I was just bubbling over and I couldn't tell anybody or talk to anybody. And it just, yeah. And as soon as it came out and the hype came, then I was just like, this feels great.
And oh, it's just also a great audience film. I mean, people were just in shock and like, you know, really on the edge of their seat. It was fantastic.
And I love how it kind of has defined this time, this year. Everything that's going on politically, like this is all, it's become a film that everybody points at.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that's going to give it a lot of staying power, not just past, you know, it's a great freaking film, but that it is so contemporary in that, you know, when people think about like the 1960s, you think about Rosemary's Baby and what it was saying about birth control and women's rights. And I think that this will be a film that gets pointed to for this time period.
And yeah, perfect for Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh my
when
God,
we heard he, like, as long as he has like some free range, but like seriously, that's what Get Out feels like. It feels like the ultimate Twilight Zone episode, even more than it does feel like horror at times. And man, when I heard that, I was like, geez, that's a good choice.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And I mean, I'll wrap it up with that because my number one is Get Out. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like, it's amazing. Sometimes things are just meant to be. Mm-hmm. And the idea that he made this before what's going on politically right now, you know, when Obama was still president, he had his finger on the pulse of what was really kind of going on in this country. And it's kind of encapsulated in this fun horror movie. And yeah, like Becca said, I think when people look back at this time period, in particular, the time that Trump became president, the first movie that will be associated with that is going to be Get Out.
It came out on the first couple of months.
It came out right after.
Yeah.
So
and
this
I'd say Purge Election a little bit is starting to get there, but then Get Out
that
just
was right
like pushed
before.
It.
But that's the other thing. Purge Election isn't that good. So it won't have, the, you know, it's okay.
It's a fun movie, but not
Get Out's
a great
like
movie.
Gonna have that. Like, it's like Night of the Living Dead. It's like, boom, you'll remember it for that time period.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's my number one is Get Out.
That's pretty great. So here we go.
Oh, man.
All right. I'm ready for I wish Ryan was here. As I just said, Get Out is the best horror film of the year. And now I'm going to recite a little poetry for you. And then you're going to know exactly where I'm going with this. And you will agree to an extent because this is the water and this is the well. Drink full and descend. Because Twin Peaks Episode 8 was the scariest thing I saw all year.
Wait, wow, I did TV a couple of years ago and you guys called
this
cinema police
Twin
on
Twin Peaks
me.
Isn't television. Because where did you watch Gerald's Game?
Oh,
on TV.
No, but it's not.
Where did you watch? No,
it's an Gerald's original game. Movie on Netflix.
Yes, but it's a movie.
David Lynch handed in a 400-page script for a movie
but
script
it's
to them.
Still and then episodic.
It's episodic.
But then I could have included Stranger Things.
You could do whatever you want.
No, I can't because y'all
can.
Freaking
television.
This is just
the
off
movie.
The rails this year.
I'm telling
this
you.
Madness.
This is what changes TV forever.
I tried to keep the rules, everybody, but they won't listen to
in
me.
My opinion, in my opinion, this changed like what the definition forever because it's already blurred now because of Netflix. Because by putting these movies out, they aren't ever going theatrical. So you have to call them a movie because they're 2 hours and they're being put somewhere for you to watch as a movie. Twin Peaks does not have cliffhangers, did not have – it was nothing like the original Twin Peaks. It is the biggest hole in my heart. Like, as I was watching it, I'm not going to lie, there's episodes where I didn't even know what the fuck was going on, episodes where I was disappointed, episodes where I laughed, episodes where I was getting sick of Dale Cooper's character. But my God, episode 8 and the final episode, which is also, even though it's can be frustrating, is fucking scary. Like, and I'm putting this on the list because, not just because of the TV thing, I don't care about that, but when I really dug deep, I realized I think Get Out's still the best horror film of the year by far. I think that this was easily the only time I went somewhere totally where I couldn't predict what the hell was going to happen. It was visionary. It was scary. It was weird. The creature guys, I don't want to put spoilers for those who haven't seen Twin Peaks yet, in this particular episode. This episode looked like it had 10 times the budget of every other episode of this show, and it's special. And
you,
it's cinematic.
You can't spoil it.
You can't
it's
spoil
impossible.
It. It's so cinematic. It's like 2001 mixed with a horror film. And it really, like, I Get Out was number one for a long time and thing. And I was just like, you know what? I got to be honest. The one moment I had of the year where I was watching horror and I just didn't know, I was like kind of like stuck and like couldn't even move, was watching that. Kind of, wow. I haven't had that feeling since I saw Lost Highway in a theater where I was like, oh my fucking God. That's how I felt. So it pushed itself above two movies that I am just totally high on. So for it to do that, I had a hint, guys. Look at the shirt.
I'm
wearing a Twin Peaks shirt. But the return is, like, to me, is like really something special this year, and I miss it as much as frustration as it held as well. I miss that weekly thing, whatever it was. So
Becca, how dare you follow this?
I know, I can't because mine's just really boring. It's
Number one.
Yeah,
okay.
Number one.
You and Ryan.
Yeah, because and for very similar reasons to Ryan, the kind of idea of like a destination film. It takes a lot for me to go to a theater now. I have two kids and I really like my couch and I have a nice TV. And yeah, and I think like many, many people, it's just kind of much nicer to watch it at home in my sweatpants with my food than to go to a theater. I am so fucking glad I saw it in the theater.
Yeah.
I saw it and I didn't even expect it to be this amazing of a screening, because it opened and I didn't even see it the opening weekend because I think I was in Phoenix. I was someplace. And so I saw it the second weekend on a Sunday. It wasn't even the matinee. It was like the 3:30 showing. And it was sold out, completely packed. And this was in not the good theater in downtown Burbank. This was like the one under what used to be the IKEA and is now just a vacant building.
Yeah.
And so I saw it there. Still completely sold out, packed theater. People screaming, howling, writhing in the seats. It was my best horror experience of the year by far. And it's one, though Get Out, I will say Get Out, I think, is probably the most important film by far. It is the one that made me say, this is why I'm a fucking horror fan. I just had the best time today and I was scared out of my mind with, 100 other people. And this was just fun.
Wow. So. Wow.
It's great, but I feel a little guilty. But now we're in honorable mentions. It was like in my 9 spot on my way here. And then I was like between it and Tragedy Girls. I felt like the need to give Tragedy Girls some love because it's lesser known.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take away from it. It was like definitely like Annabelle was the most.
Wait, was it in your top 10 at all?
It was at number 9, but I bumped it at the last minute for Tragedy Girls. So
oh my God,
I think
wow.
It was partially just to get a couple lesser known films. But don't get me wrong. I'm definitely on the side of – I thought it was – I think one of the problems it has, which it was you kind of mentioned when you said – and a positive, you said it has like a great scare every 5 minutes. I think at a certain point with a movie that long, that can lead to a bit of exhaustion.
Yeah.
And a couple of the tropes wore by the end. But that doesn't take away from it being just hugely entertaining. And I love the world the kids all inhabited.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were all great.
But
yeah.
That – and there was a couple. Like, for me, it was like a lot of these art house ones would have like – whether it's Mother, It Comes at Night, they all had like a sequence that I thought was just brilliant this year, and then but as a whole I was underwhelmed. So if I could Frankenstein between 4 or 5 of these weird movies, I'd probably have the perfect movie. But a lot of them, just for me, including the one I was talking about, Thelma, last week, a lot of them have sequences that are so strong and such a sharp eye, but again, they're also kind of scared to be horror.
Yeah,
that's
don't
want
to be horror films somehow.
I liked you talked about it a couple of weeks ago, Most Beautiful Island. I watched in prep for this show, and I felt the same way, where I was like, it feels like it just kind of fell into horror, where most of the movie, it's like a statement on immigration and a drama.
But
and
good then sequence towards the end, right?
Really good sequence really good. Towards the end. Yeah. I would put that on my good
sequences. Yeah, that would make my list of like best sequence moments of the year.
Same thing with the Transfiguration, where I just, most of the movie, I was like, this is kind of just meandering, and it's about PTSD and suicide, and he's clearly got some psychological issues, and she's got some, you know, some abuse issues. Oh, and there's a really cool horror sequence. Nope, now we're back to the issues. So yeah, it's, I didn't know where to go with it.
As we are wrapping, any what are some quick honorable mentions?
Yeah, and you know what? Since Ryan's not here, we'll have him tweet it out. You know, but yeah, just a quick fire.
Yeah, just throw some out.
This one definitely wasn't in my top 10, but I had a really good time with it. The Void, just because the effects.
I didn't like that one at all.
See, it had no plot, but it to me.
No, it had a lot of plot, a lot of other films' plots all forced together.
It had Hellraiser and From Beyond, and it had some cool stuff with cults, but the effects. Like, I never, even though that it did have a lot of other plots and it felt very derivative, there was never a point where I wanted to turn it off or that I felt like I had something else to do.
The filmmakers are fun. They're having fun doing it.
They had fun, and it was one of the first movies where I liked that the effects were on display. It didn't feel like they were trying to keep them in the shadows the whole time like you do in indie horror. It was just kind of like, here's our big giant fucking monster, and here it is in broad daylight. And I liked that. So, yeah.
Let's see. For me, really quick, I've already mentioned a dozen times The Dark Tower. I don't care. Come at me. I like it. I think the third act is amazing. This is on my list a lot, and it just missed out after a long run. But Split, I thought,
yeah.
I feel the same.
Split was a return to form for M. Night Shyamalan. Yeah. It actually was scary. It was well acted. You know, the twist is almost irrelevant. It's kind of cool, just the way that it ties into some of his other properties. But it's for the most part, it was just it was kind of like the Visit I like, but I think The Visit is goofy. And I don't take it seriously at all. Yeah. This was him returning to kind of that serious, scary filmmaker he was in those first few films. So I love that. There was a little indie movie that I saw and talked about on the show several months ago called Aaron's Blood, which isn't great, but it's got a lot of heart to it. And I really liked it, which is basically a guy whose son got a blood transfusion and it was the blood of a vampire. And so now his kid is a vampire. Again, it's really low budget, but there was some pretty good acting in it and a couple of really interesting twists to the vampire genre that I'd not really seen done before. And so I really appreciated that one, and I think it deserves a little love. So Aaron's Blood. And last but not least, got to give a shout out to Cult of Chucky, quite frankly, because the thing about the Chucky series at this point is I'm just so impressed with what Don Mancini has been able to do. It is unlike any other horror franchise in that one of the main creators has been a part of every entry and every movie. I know you were going through them all. Every movie takes a complete left turn and delivers a different type of horror movie. And so I don't know any other franchise that has successfully done that and yet maintained continuity the entire way. Like, everything counts. And so I had a lot of fun watching that when it came out. Again, it's not great. There's a few little things about it that bother me. Chucky's voice, not Brad Dourif, but the Chucky doll voice. I don't know why they didn't just use the Chucky doll voice. That's like threw me off a bit and kind of reveals a little bit of the budget when it's when you get things like that. But as far as just getting another cool Chucky sequel, like, it was just a lot of fun. Yeah. So
I'll start my new year watching the two last ones because I haven't gone there yet.
Cool.
So that's where I'm up to. I don't have many because I feel like we've been talking about them along the way. But I just want to restate that I really do think Annabelle really only just missed out. At my 10th spot, I was like going through a bunch. But I think more than anything, I just think Sandberg knocked it out of the park. But another one, the Australian film no one's really talked about called Hounds of Love. I really like this movie. It didn't quite make the cut for the 10, but I think if you haven't seen it, check out Hounds of Love. It's available now on Amazon Prime and places like that. I think it's dark subject matter, but it's done in a way that it kind of stays with you. And there's tons of like movies that you liked parts of and stuff, but I feel like this year, I don't know, maybe this year I was just getting like tougher on things that I liked, where I was like,
There's parts of Alien Covenant that I liked.
Yeah,
like,
parts
I put
of that
down
yeah.
as, like, you know, I enjoyed it when I was in the theater. When I walked away, I really wanted it to be something new and unique and more kind of Prometheus-like, where I was like, I don't know what to expect it. I've never seen anything like this. But that said, there were still some cool sequences in it. It was nice to have them back. Belko Experiment was another
one. Actually, that would be an honorable mention. That
yeah, I enjoyed Belko Experiment. I'm not sure if it's anything that's, you know, going to be memorable or landmark later, but I enjoyed it while I was watching it.
Yeah, yeah, I thought it was fun. And Happy Death Day didn't make my 10, but that was, I think it's more just because I always like want to put the weird serious movies love, but it doesn't reflect how I feel. I loved it. I thought it was super fun. So yeah, it was a good year, man.
And it was a great year doing Shockwaves with you guys. Obviously, I'm sure you'll probably have other lists, like your regular film lists.
I'm going to do a weird, for Pearson, I'm going to do one where we're just do 10 things we saw this year that we hadn't seen.
Everybody's weirdest.
Some will be old, some will be new.
Weirdest discovery, The Devil's Honey.
You know what? That's really one of my favorite things I've seen.
I was waiting for us to put that because we did that last year, the best old discovery. And I was like, well, it's The Devil's Honey. I don't have to research
it
that.
It is. It's so crazy. It's also fun because then you could tell someone about it.
Yeah.
It's got a viral quality.
On the Shockwaves fan club site, I've enjoyed watching the Shockers like discover it. And then we'll get like links.
There's like a new person every day that like, mentions
I've
it.
I've enjoyed Shockers discovering that there's a Shockwaves podcast. What? There's a podcast?
Welcome to you all who are new from the group.
Yeah.
But no, it's been great. You know, obviously, we thank you guys for all your support. It's been a hell of a year. We did a lot of good shows. We had a lot of great guests. We saw a lot of great movies. But really, it's because of you guys that we keep doing this sort of thing. And it's been great interacting. We will try over the break on Twitter to talk about other things, non-genre movies we loved. I just did a blog on my favorite vinyl soundtracks.
Cool.
And so I think all three of us will probably be posting stuff like that that we didn't have time to get to today. But sincerely, thank you so much for everything.
We'll be back early January.
We'll be back
next year, but it'll be early next year.
Yeah, and we'll do our preview of 2018 films.
Yeah,
and it'd be fun to go to more cons. I don't know if we can or get our shit together, but I know we're going to Texas, but it'd be super fun to get to a couple more.
If you have any conventions out there that we should be hitting, or if you happen to have a convention, please reach out. We're definitely interested in some travel this year.
Travel again.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's to 2018. Be safe. And stay bonkers.
Yep, stay bonkers, keep it shocking.